The Health and Human Services Committee will come to order. Sabrina, please call the roll.
Chair Fine.
Here.
Persons Malika, Representatives Persons Malika.
Here.
Salzman.
Here.
Skidmore.
Here.
Amnesty.
Here.
Anderson.
Here.
Baker.
Here.
Clements.
Here.
Cross.
Here.
Dunkley.
Here.
Edmonds.
Present.
Gant.
Present.
Grant.
Here.
Coster.
Here.
Masula.
Here.
Plankin.
Here.
Rizzio.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Tribuzzi.
Here.
Woodson.
Yeah.
Yurkowski.
Here.
Quorum is present.
Thank you, Sabrina. As we begin, I ask everyone to be sure to silence your cell phones. I actually didn't know how many people would show up today. I thought we might not have a full house, so it's nice to see everyone here. Members, we're here to take a look at one of the most obscure segments of the healthcare industry, prescription drug purchasing and distribution. With us today is a panel to discuss the role of pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs. I'm going to take a minute, kind of give the 100,000-foot level on what they do in a second. But as we do that, I want folks to keep in mind the big three takeaways I have made thus far in the healthcare industry in general as a businessman. And I think they're instructive for us to think about as we look through this lens and any others. We want to talk about healthcare as a business, but it differs from other businesses in three fundamental ways. The first is, particularly for some of our providers, it's the only industry that is not allowed to engage in price discrimination. What I mean by that, in any other business, if you show up at the store and say, I want services, but I can't pay you, they invite you to move along. But in some of our healthcare entities, you can show up, you can say, I want a whole lot of stuff, it might even cost millions of dollars, I can't pay you, and by law, you're required to give it to them. Once you relax the ability to engage in price discrimination, you're no longer a free market. I think that's the first thing. The second thing is the role of government. Half the people in Florida that are insured by the government, whether it's Medicaid or Medicare, roughly. But even many of those who aren't have their health insurance, which I'll talk about in a minute, subsidized to some degree by the government. There's no other business product that is bought in the United States where such a large percentage of that product is purchased by the government. And then the third and final thing is, and this is something that's happened in our country over the last few decades, is I'm going to continue to describe health insurers, but we don't really have health insurers anymore in this country. Then I want you to think about, imagine if when you bought car insurance, that your gas, your tires, and your oil were paid for by your auto insurance. Well, that's the situation that people find themselves today in health insurance. It's really the idea of insurance is the pooling of risk to forestall unavoidable situations, aka getting hit by a bus or getting cancer. Flu shots, wellness checks, not opining on whether they should be paid for or not by your insurance company, but once you integrate expected routine items into your insurance, it's no longer insurance. It's health care. And I think that's a big part of things that I want folks to just sort of keep in mind in general, not just about PBMs moving forward. So what do PBMs do? Well, they administer prescription drug benefit programs for commercial insurers and HMOs, self-insured employers, and government health care programs. One, insurers and employers contract with PBMs to negotiate with drug manufacturers to theoretically purchase drugs at reduced prices or with the promise of rebates. This often involves developing drug formularies, which are tiered drug lists that incentivize the use of some drugs over others. And two, PBMs also establish pharmacy networks for the health plans, aka where you can go as an individual to get your prescription drugs. They contract with pharmacies to provide services for the health plan's enrollees and set payment amounts for drugs covered in those health plans. PBMs also process the drug reimbursement claims from those pharmacies. The U.S. pharmaceutical supply is complex. It involves multiple organizations that play different, sometimes overlapping roles in drug distribution and contracting. A flowchart that we'll keep up for most of today demonstrates those relationships. It's on the screen and it's in your packets. With us today are a few of the players in this system: pharmacies, PBMs, insurers, and drug manufacturers. And I would emphasize to everyone that this is the start of a conversation as it relates to PBMs that we'll have over the next 30, 60, 90 days through session. There's no way that we can all learn everything that we need to understand about this in the next 90 minutes, but I thought we'd sort of get it kicked off today and get people thinking about it. So with us, we've got six folks. And by the way, I had no shortage of people volunteer to be on this panel. So there's plenty of people who are interested in speaking, but I appreciate you six for being here. We have Kevin Duane with PharmD, Panama Pharmacy. Steve McCall, Vice President of Network Services for CVS Health. Kristen Pardee, the Deputy Vice President of Policy for Pharma, PHRMA. Dr. Jeffrey T. Martorana, MD, the Chief Medical Director of FHAP. Johnny Garcia, State Government Affairs with Prime Therapeutics, and Katie Scanlon, Director of Pharmacy Operations with Publix. So panelists, what I'd like to do today is give our panelists 5 to 6 minutes to open, and then so we have the bulk of the time for member questions. So, you know, 30 to 40 minutes for you know, you to say whatever you want, and then members will have time to ask you questions as well, recognizing that 90 minutes would simply never be enough to let everyone ask what it is that they would like to ask. And again, I'm sure many of you have gotten meeting requests from some of these people. So obviously, you know, there's plenty of interest in answering our questions. All right, so that's what we're gonna do. And I'm gonna sort of be mean, which I'm good at, after 5 or 6 minutes to ask people to kind of bring it in for a landing so we have time for everybody. We're gonna start with Mr. Duane, owner of Panama Pharmacy. Mr. Duane, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair Fine, and thank you, members of the House Health and Human Services Committee. My name is Dr. Kevin Duane, and I'm a pharmacist and I'm a pharmacy owner in Jacksonville. Thank you for the opportunity today to provide insight and clarity regarding an issue affecting the people who I care for in my community, an issue that, if left unresolved, will most certainly lead to the loss of critical access to care in many communities across Florida like my own. Pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs as they're more commonly known, were originally intended to serve as middlemen claim and benefit processors for health plans. But as time has gone on, and due to market consolidation and vertical integration, these PBMs have mutated into a vastly disproportionate sized role in the entire drug supply chain. They can now determine where patients can receive pharmacy services. They can dictate to physicians and patients which medications can be utilized through formulary design and management. And they can decide how much a covered patient will pay at the counter. This outsized role has led to a tremendous inefficiency in the prescription drug supply chain, and it's significantly limited consumer choice. I believe that a patient should have a right to choose which pharmacy they want to receive services from. Right now in Florida, a PBM can change the amount a patient is charged based on where they go. So while patients may want to use my pharmacy, sometimes their out-of-pocket costs are higher, even sometimes as much as paying 100% of the cost of the drug. While the out-of-pocket cost at a PBM-affiliated or a mail-order pharmacy can be much less. With some health plans and payers, including some Medicaid plans in our state, we're not even offered to receive a contract for services. Allowing a PBM to dictate where a patient must go to receive pharmacy services is antithetical to the idea of a patient-centered, consumer-directed healthcare system. Right now in this country, 3 PBMs control roughly 8 out of every 10 prescriptions that are filled. They are out-of-state, multi-billion dollar enterprises, a few even ranking in the top 5 of the Fortune 500. Because they've integrated with so many parts of the supply chain, they dictate to us our contract terms while also owning our direct competitor pharmacies. We don't have the ability to refuse such contract terms. What's offered to us is take it or leave it. There's no way to negotiate. Poorly paying contracts are a win-win for their enterprise in that if we accept the bad terms, they can profit on the spread that it provides. And if we refuse it, it only drives further business to their owned and affiliated pharmacy entities. They decide which pharmacies participate in their network. They decide the amount the pharmacy gets paid. They decide what a patient pays at the pharmacy. They decide whether a patient can go to a brick-and-mortar pharmacy or a mail-order pharmacy. And they can decide to limit access to their competitors. In essence, they're the judge, jury, and executioner of small business pharmacies in Florida. Anything that's done legislatively must also protect Florida's small businesses from these abusive practices that distort the free market. So at the end of it all, I'm a Floridian, a pharmacist, a small business owner, and a member of a community just like one of yours. The patients that I care for are my primary concern. And Florida has spent many years reforming how healthcare is delivered, requiring transparency, patient-centered, consumer-directed care. So I urge you to ask yourself, are PBMs furthering these goals? The way that they operate, does it improve the quality of care? And are things set up the way in this space to optimize the use of scarce dollars? As this committee and the legislature takes up this important legislative package alongside our governor, please remember this. PBMs don't invent prescription drugs. They don't manufacture them. They don't buy or sell prescription drugs. They don't diagnose or treat any condition that would require the use of prescription drugs. They don't dispense drugs to a patient. They don't counsel them on their intended use. But somehow, these entities, once thought of as simple claims processors, now decide which pharmacies can and cannot provide these services, which medications a physician can or cannot prescribe, and how much or how little a person will pay at the counter for the medication. We must work together to right these wrongs for the betterment of our patients, for our small business owners, and Florida's taxpayers. Thank you for your time, and thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. That was a great presentation at 3 minutes and 40 seconds. So you know, you definitely scored some points here. And thank you. I'm sure people have questions, but we'll get to those after all of the presenters did a good job. But you did a very good job making your case. Now we're going to move to sort of the other side of the world. We're going to hear from Mr. McCall with CVS Health. Mr. McCall, you are recognized. And if you want to take your full 5 to 6 minutes, that's okay.
No, I think the gauntlet's been thrown down. I'll go short as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to come here, and thank you for everyone that's attending, as well as the fellow committee members over here. I think one of the things that I'd like to just go ahead and talk about here is that we really are not that far away as far as what our goals are for the patient care. What we have right now is a misperception as to what PBMs actually do. So from a pharmacy benefit manager, my job is to make sure there's quality health care. And I'm a pharmacist to start with as well. I started off as a pharmacist in Central Florida about 27 years ago. And even though I've moved on and lost a little bit of hair along the way, I'm still a Floridian at heart. So in my mind, what audit is here for is to make sure that we are checking to make sure that we have quality health care that's conducted. There are a lot of different pharmacists, and as I sit next to Dr. Duane here, I think that we have a lot of the same common goals to take care of our patients. But not all pharmacists are as cognizant with regards to how we're taking care of patients. So that's where you bring audit into the mix. If you think about it, what a pharmacy benefits manager is really doing is we represent business. We represent small businesses and large businesses that want to provide a benefit to their patients as far as a pharmacy benefit that can be taken care of, but they want it to be done properly. So when audit comes in and takes a look at it, if you can think about it, we are having pharmacies sell things. My job is to come in and make sure that it was done properly, and that gives an incentive for quality health care to go along. If we look at the eye chart that's up on the board up here, you can see how complicated the ecosystem for pharmacy benefits are. There's a lot of people that are involved, and ultimately, we are all taking care of that patient, and that's our job. My client is, from a patient-centric perspective, is actually the business that's buying that insurance. So if you have, say, a small law firm, 8 patients that want to go ahead and provide the benefits to their members, if you have a large business like a Home Depot that's going to provide for quite a few patients at the same time, they want high-quality, low-cost health care. And so that's where we come into the mix. The misperception, I think, that goes on is the small business owner that is buying insurance is the one that directs the pharmacy benefit manager on how to administer. If they want certain drugs on their formulary to get a certain desired effect, that's what the employer can go ahead and choose from. A wide network, that's what the employer can choose from. So we're here to serve the benefits of the business, and you were exactly on the nose when you said it's an exceedingly complicated system. So when we're all said and done, what we would request is that we take care of the entire system, we're transparent about it, and as we are going through any potential bills, that we try to mitigate any unintended consequences. Thank you for your time.
All right, well, you did even better, 3 minutes and 7 seconds. No, so again, now we're getting a little bit ahead of schedule, which is not a bad thing, but again, folks should be able to use up their time. We're actually going to skip over, we're not, sorry, hard for me to read. Next, we're now going to hear from Ms. Pardy with the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. I think you're getting your presentation up here. We're not going to count that against your time. You got to push the little button to make it.
The full screen.
Yeah, the full screen button. Otherwise, it won't click down there on the bottom right. Nope. There you go with the little thing with the, go over a little. Go over, yep, next to the minus. I used to give a lot of presentations. So there you go. That's it. Right there. There you go. All right. So you're recognized.
Thank you very much. Usually I'm better at that part, and I apologize, but I will make sure I'm quick here. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I really appreciate your time today. I'm Kristen Pardee. I'm with Pharma. We represent 32 of the nation's leading biopharmaceutical companies. Our companies have invested $1.1 trillion in R&D in the last since 2000, and that includes over $102 billion just in 2021 alone. And so I wanted to just quickly sort of look at the process of what we do to give you a visual. R&D is our thing. And the process itself, you know, is lengthy, it's complicated, and it's challenging. And just a quick snapshot here, you'll see that over the course of the drug trial process, it takes about 10 to 15 years to bring a drug to market. And that is at a cost of an average about $2.6 billion. And while it can be very challenging, you can see here that like 12% of medicines that are in the investigational phase actually make it to market, which is an 88% failure rate. That doesn't mean that there's not a tremendous amount of success. In fact, 900 drugs have been approved by the FDA since 2000. And we're looking at a pipeline of about 8,000 drugs, and that includes new and innovative therapies like gene therapies and cell therapies, which are really going to change the course of medicine in the future. Despite all that, the share of spending on pharmaceuticals has remained stable. It's about 14% of the healthcare spend in this country. In addition, net prices for drugs have gone up about 1% in 2021, and we look at that only going up about 0% or less, negative 3% in the upcoming 5 years. Keeping in mind that the average net price for a drug is about 49% lower than list, and that will come in a little bit. It's also important to look at the value of medicine over time. Our entire industry is based on the fact that over the lifespan, generics play a gigantic role. About 91% of the drugs dispensed in the country today are for generics, and that comes with tremendous savings, especially as you see on the slide and in your materials, as biosimilars begin to play a larger and larger place in the market. You're looking at a 5x increase in savings in the billions within the next 5 years. And finally, there's also the thought of what does this mean to just overall economic costs. In this country right now, about 60% of Americans suffer from a chronic disease, one or two, and of that, about 40% of them have two or more chronic diseases, which accounts for 90% of the total costs of our healthcare system. But $1 spent on medicines and adherence to those medicines can save $10 in avoidable healthcare costs like ER visits, hospitalizations, amputations, and the things that come with not having treated conditions. So now talking, you know, really about the PBM market and why we're here and the challenges that we see. So as we've said, there's, you know, of the PBM market, the three largest PBMs control about 80% of the market. So that's around 180 lives. That means it's significant negotiating power. On top of that, a lot of them, because of vertical integration, are controlled by or owned by insurers or perhaps they own insurers. And that gives them a lot of opportunity to negotiate, especially when it comes from the rebate side from manufacturers. And the rebates, as you can see here, it's 204, but it's actually the most recent numbers was $236 billion. And what happens on the other side of that is the negotiations for will the product even be covered? You know, in a lot of cases, they aren't covered because the negotiations just don't work out. What does that mean for the consumer? What's their cost sharing going to be? What tier is this drug going to be on? Because a lot of the plans have drugs from, you know, your regular to your tier four, where the cost sharing could be upwards of 40%. What kind of utilization management? Are they going to have prior authorization? Are they going to have step therapy or fail first? And as well as physician incentives. So there is a lot that these negotiations ride on as far as access to these medicines and coverage. I just wanted to show a quick thing. I'm not going to go into this to save time. It was already mentioned earlier. And this also just shows sort of a look at how rebates have grown over the past number of years. In fact, they've doubled since 2012. So that's very significant. Another issue with this is that you're really looking at a linking of payment and price to access. And so, you know, as we talk about those problems, we also have to realize patients aren't seeing these rebates to lower their drug costs. They are seeing a lot more higher deductibles. They're seeing greater cost sharing. But what they aren't seeing is these actual rebates for drugs lowering their drug cost. In fact, as you can see on the right side, almost half of patients currently are paying costs based on list price, not on the net price. And that is a tremendous struggle, especially when you are having cost sharing of 40% and really high deductibles. And so this is a challenge for all of our patients, and you really end up with a system where the sick are subsidizing the healthy, which is an unusual place for insurance to be. And to sort of underline this, it's not like this in the rest of the market. You know, the rest of the market, you really are paying on those negotiated prices. When you go to your doctor's office, you know, you're paying based on the negotiations. When you have a hospital visit, it's the same thing. But that doesn't apply to the prescription drug benefit, and it really needs to. And I think I'm about time, but I just wanted to say quickly, you know, there are a lot of policy solutions out there, looking at things from what can we do for the patients at the pharmacy counter, what can we do to pass through those rebates. West Virginia just recently passed a bill where rebates get passed through to the consumer at the pharmacy counter so they can see that benefit directly. And that can have an impact up to $1,000 a year for certain patients, and we see a premium increase of around 0.6% at the highest. Things like making sure that patients' assistance programs apply to their deductibles. They're not just paying and paying and paying and never having to see the benefit from that, as well as more systemic reforms. What do we do about the fact that rebates seem to be tied to the financials of all the supply chain, and how can that be changed, as well as things like looking at steering and a lot of things I know you all have considered over the past few years. There's plenty of policy options out there. We'd, of course, be happy to discuss them more in the future.
Thank you. All right, thank you. That was a great, another good presentation. All right, now we're going to hear from Dr. Martirana with the Florida Association of Health Plans. Dr. Martirana, you're now recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Fine. My name is Dr. Jeff Martirana. I'm a board-certified family physician, have been in the state for over 30 years of my 35 years in both clinical practice and working in the managed care arena. I'm currently the Chief Medical Officer for Florida Association of Health Plans and serve on the state's Medicaid Drug Utilization Board and have been for the past 8 years chair of that committee. In my various roles in my career, the number one thing that always comes to the forefront is the patient. Patient always comes first. And the challenge is to how do I help provide affordable, safe, and quality health care to those individuals. And, you know, PBMs are an integral part of the entire makeup of the healthcare system. I've served on a number of P&T committees and been involved in evaluating the hiring and firing of PBMs for the various roles that they play within that healthcare market. You know, as Chairman Fine had in his opening remarks said, they do provide assistance in developing and maintaining lists of formularies on behalf of the health insurers. And the, you know, I hate to say health insurers because most companies these days, it's just not insurance of paying claims, but it's managing of patient care. Helping to influence which drug individuals use and the determination of those out-of-pocket costs are paramount because it doesn't do anything for me to write a prescription if the patient doesn't go to the pharmacy and fill it. And because they can't afford it, they can't afford the copay, or they can't get to the pharmacy. You know, we've heard many times here from the group that the purchasing power to negotiate rebates and our garner discounts is an integral part of what PBMs do. They contract directly with pharmacies. Maintaining those networks of pharmacies is something that is an awesome feat in and amongst itself. I think there's over 3,000 pharmacies across the state of Florida, and for a health plan to be able to develop that network and maintain that network would be somewhat a massive undertaking. You know, by allowing the PBMs to help administer this benefit, they provide for real-time adjudication of claims, which if anyone's gone to the doctor and seen how you know, your claim might be paid several months later and you still don't know what your cost is associated with that visit is a feat in on amongst itself. They also offer a suite of services for quality. So they look for fraud, waste, and abuse as to what might be going on. They can perform either desk audits or on-site audits to make sure that the drugs that are being dispensed are the correct drugs and that the co-pays and deductibles are administered correctly, as well as the ability to work on the safety and efficacy side. So there could be age limit edits to make sure that the drugs that are prescribed are going to the right age level of patients that they're being offered to. Any type of drug-drug interactions real-time at the pharmacy. So if you're on a drug and receiving another one that might have an adverse reaction, that could be flagged up to the pharmacist to say, hey, we need to go back and take a look at this. There could be step edits involved so that you're looking at the most cost-effective drug for the initial treatment of a potential disease or disease state, and then also some of the prior authorizations that might be inherent relating to those drug edits. So overall, again, PBMs play a vital role in the overall integration within the health system. They partner with the managed care organizations to afford the quality and affordable drug benefits throughout members, and that you know, I think we all here to make sure that the access of healthcare is wide, that it is affordable, but first and foremost, that is quality. So, thank you.
Great, thank you. Now we're going to hear with Mr. Garcia with Prime Therapeutics. Mr. Garcia, you're recognized. We got another presentation coming up.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. Dr. Johnny Garcia, I'm a pharmacist with Prime Therapeutics. I've been in mail order, retailer, and specialty pharmacy for the last 23 years. So I've kind of seen all aspects of that. Like my colleagues down the way here, they talking about their options or their lack of options within the independent pharmacies, how CVS operates with audits. You know, working in a specialty pharmacy, I've been able to work directly with manufacturers and bringing drug products onto the market. So I've kind of seen all of it. So what I'd like to go through today, though, is just some things about PBMs. So as Chairman Fine said earlier, PBMs are the administrators of pharmacy benefits provided by the health plan sponsors. We've heard that several times. So these plans are designed by the employer or picked by the employer for the health plan to deliver, and then the PBM help delivers the pharmacy portion of that. So we have multiple tools that we use, as we've talked about already, to get these through. So why do we exist? Well, we exist to help get the right drugs at the right place for the right cost. So our job is to put the downward pressure on manufacturers and pharmacies to deliver the lowest cost to our members. So health plans are not required to hire a PBM. This is something that they do because we have the expertise in the drug space to deliver that cost. So and how we accomplish that, as I said, we compete on quality, price, and service. So we look at our pharmacies, we look at the manufacturers, and who can deliver the best products for our patients. It's not always the most expensive product. It's always not the newest drug. Sometimes it is something that's out there that's maybe a little bit better. So we look at all of that. We have a lot of data at our hands. Obviously, we process the claims, as we've talked about before. So we have a lot of information that we can help determine what's the right thing for the patient at the right time. So we negotiate lower prescription drug prices for our members. So we've used the term rebates quite a bit here. Think of a rebate as a volume discount. So we have to hit a certain number of volume of prescriptions in order to get those discounts, also known as rebates. So it's not something that's just handed over to a PBM. It's something that we do have to work for and make sure that the patients who need them are taking them correctly. So, and then we provide clinical services and benefit design. So the clinical services, with all the information we have, we help prevent a patient from having a drug interaction. If they go to CVS and they go to Publix to fill their prescriptions, we have that information at our hands to show that there's a drug interaction between those two pharmacies, something that a pharmacist may not see if they're only working in one location. So we have access to that. So talking a little bit about pharmacy networks, we've talked about why a pharmacy may or may not be part of a network. So we, once again, compete on service, price, convenience, and quality. So if the pharmacy is not able to compete on service, price, or convenience, or quality, then they may or may not be part of our network. So in some of our networks, we have up to 60,000 pharmacies available. Those are nationwide plans. Typically, those are what's called a PPO. They're a little bit more open networks, and so you have more options. So if you want to drive down the cost, though, as this diagram on the side shows, they may a plan may want to implement an HMO, or an employer may want to choose their HMO. It's a little bit more narrow of a network, less doctors, less pharmacies, but it helps get a lower cost, up to 25% lower. So, and then we also have network adequacy requirements that we have to meet for CMS. So that's how many pharmacies are within a drivable distance from our patients. So we have to meet those requirements as well when we're looking at our networks. So as the costs have started to soar, PBMs have created preferred pharmacy networks. So those are smaller networks to help keep costs down. We have somebody that can deliver a high-quality product safely and cheaply. So those are the ones that make it into the preferred networks. We process claims, as we've talked about. It was kind of where we initially started back in 1980s when we started processing the claims electronically and online. It made it for easier moments at the pharmacy counter to pay for your prescriptions. We offer the real-time reimbursement information, and then we process the pharmacy payments back, all used in electronic systems. So a reimbursement to a pharmacy is a contracted drug price. It's something that they know that they're going to receive. The information is there. It is something that's not hidden, plus a dispensing fee. So every time they dispense a medication, they'll get a fee for that, and then the amount collected minus the amount collected by the patient at the counter. So copays can vary depending on the plan that they chose. So if they have an HMO, they may have a higher deductible than somebody that has a PPO, which is a lower deductible. So there's a real example in the appendix. I'm not going to have time to get to it, but kind of showing how a plan is set up. You've probably seen that if you've ever worked in the private sector, where you have to select one of five plans. Your deductible is $1,000 here, $7,000 there. You're paying $550 a month here versus $300 a month there. So there's an example in there. Some common misrepresented terms in the industry, spread pricing. So spread pricing are contract arrangements. Those are where a PBM will charge a little bit higher of a price, but it's a set fee for the employer to select from, and then works to try to negotiate a spread. So they work with pharmacies, get that down, and whatever the difference is what the PBM will pass through. In our case, we would pass through back to our clients because we're 100% pass through. But it's kind of the profits, if you will. Florida Finance and Facilities Committee issued a report in 2001 that's also in the appendix showing a comparison of spread pricing, fee-for-service, and pass-through models. In that, it showed that spread pricing was actually cheaper for the state, the Medicaid population, if they went with that. So, and pharmacies can't really dictate how a plan pays for their benefits. So that's the key thing with the spread pricing. Gag clauses, it's kind of an older term, but it keeps resurfacing. That's preventing a pharmacist from talking about a cheaper alternative or whatever's cheaper priced for a patient. Trump administration passed a law in 2018 prohibiting gag clauses. Florida also passed in 2018 prior to the Trump administration prohibiting gag clauses supported by PBMs. So that's kind of taken care of here in Florida. Clawbacks, that's where a pharmacy comes back and takes money back from a pharmacy after it's paid. A lot of times that is a federal program. So DIR fees, or the direct and indirect remuneration fees, is specific to CMS. CMS actually just changed their rules in 2022, and it's going to go into effect January 2024 on how DIR fees are clawed back. So that topic should go away. That's typically what clawbacks are referred to when you hear from pharmacists about that. And then Florida actually passed a law in 2018 which prohibits clawbacks in its true sense, which is where a copay may be higher than a cash price. So that's been prohibited already in Florida as well. So not an issue here. Here's a list of some of the things that have already passed. So in 2018, we kind of talked about the gag and claw pack. That's already gone through. Your state employee plan is actually in statutes effective of 2020, mandating 90-day supply. Sometimes you have to use a mail order for specific prescriptions. It talks about the reimbursement to a pharmacy, how much of the fees are going to be paid back. how a formulary is dictated, which is which drugs are covered on the plan and which ones are not covered on the plan. All of this is in statute for you guys, state employees. And then lastly, last year we had the pharmacy audit bill. So that's how we can come in and audit pharmacies to verify their quality. So any questions?
Thank you. Last, but certainly not least, we're going to hear from Ms. Scanlon with Publix. You are recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Fine and members of the committee, for allowing me to share Publix's perspective on this important issue. My name is Katie Scanlon. I'm the Senior Director of Pharmacy Administration for Publix. I'm a pharmacist. I've worked for Publix my entire career, about 15 and a half years now. Publix operates 1,324 grocery stores, in which 1,246 are pharmacies across seven states. In the state of Florida, we have 795 pharmacies with about 175,000 employees. Over the last 5 years, Florida has seen a significant decline in the number of brick-and-mortar pharmacies within the state. In the same time, Publix has opened 85 new pharmacies in Florida. Publix values the patient-pharmacist relationship and believes that community pharmacy plays a key role in patient care. Pharmacists are often the only healthcare provider patients see on a regular basis and can be easily accessed. No need for an appointment or to take time off work, as our hours allow for easy patient and flexible patient access. As you've heard a couple of times today already, there are three PBMs that control 80% of the prescription volume market in this country. There's been significant consolidation and vertical integration over the last several years, where we hear the promise of increased access and lower costs, but we have seen the opposite. We continue to have this conversation, you know, for over a decade. I think we've heard about PBM reform, and we continue to hear about high prescription drug costs and increased burden on consumers. The PBMs own their own pharmacies, mail and specialty, allowing them to steer patients to these affiliated entities. And patients are only able to access their pharmacist by telephone. When issues come up with their prescriptions, they show up at a Publix asking, you know, what can I do? My prescription's been sitting at in my mailbox. It's been 100 degrees, or I missed my prescription's missing or delayed. And our hands are tied, as, you know, we're not in network or the preferred pharmacy, and the prescription's already been filled. The PBMs, through their contracting processes, restrict the services that community pharmacies like Publix can offer, like not allowing for us to mail or deliver prescriptions where their in-network pharmacy that they own is allowed to provide those services. In-network pharmacies are being reimbursed in some cases at or below the cost of the drug, with no recognition of the necessary professional services provided by the pharmacist. Despite our significant presence in Florida, as at 785 pharmacies, a lot of you might think, wow, that's a lot of pharmacies. You should have some great negotiating power, and it's simply not the case. We are viewed by the PBMs as a small regional player and are provided take-it-or-leave-it terms that are unfair, inequitable, and often fluid. So the rules of the engagement are constantly changing in a unilateral fashion by the PBM. Our only option is then to be excluded from the network. We've seen larger regional pharmacies be kicked out of pharmacy networks when they attempt to push back on these tactics. The unpredictable and non-transparent business practices of the PBMs are threatening the viability of the pharmacy businesses and ultimately hurting Floridians. We believe comprehensive PBM reform is called for. Thank you again, Chairman Fine and the committee, for your time.
Okay, thank you. Now, if you all were as efficient with your businesses as you were with your presentations, drug costs would be very low, I think. So thank you. We actually did great there on time. So at this point, I'd really like to allow members to ask questions. So Whip Salzman, you're recognized. And if you've got questions, just sort of wave your hand at me so I can start to make a list.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to each of you for coming and taking time to make this presentation to the committee. I have a few questions for a few of you, and then I'm going to wrap it up with some just common sense, maybe practical questions for one of our local pharmacists to kind of bring it home so the folks here can understand practically what we're talking about. So for our CVS, Steve McCall, sir, I have, I think, four questions for you. So when PBM started,
I may make sure there's time for everybody.
Yep, so I'll be fast.
Go ahead and get started, but
yes, sir.
Right now I only have four names, so there should
Great.
Be time.
Thank you. When PBM started, did they get a flat fee?
You're recognized.
So I'm just here to talk about audit. My understanding is when it started off, there was a professional, a fee that's paid by the plan sponsor in order to administer the benefit. But that was, that predates me, luckily.
Thank you.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Does CVS make money doing the spread pricing, clawback, steering, rebates, fees, group purchasing, and charging patients on the list price?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. For that one, again, I'm here to talk about audit. I think we have a gentleman from Optum that can go ahead and speak about more on the PBM in general, but I'm more of a specialist.
Okay. Follow
Mr. Chair, can we defer to?
Sure. Mr. Garcia, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. So for Prime Therapeutics, we do not offer spread pricing as our primary contract. If the plan or the employer asks for it, we would provide that with other contracts as well. In spread pricing contracts, there is the difference between what is paid to the plan because it's a set fee and easier for budgeting versus what may be the spread to a pharmacy.
Okay. Follow up?
Do you oppose transparency in pricing?
No, ma'am. I believe it's fair for everybody, though. It needs to be across all lines of business, from manufacturers, PSAOs, pharmacists, wholesalers. I believe it's fair for everybody.
Okay.
And why do PBMs make it so difficult for employers, the state, and other purchasers to audit their plans?
That may be better fielded back to Mr. McCall.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I don't believe that we do make it difficult for our plan sponsors. So one of the things that the gentleman next to me may be surprised about is how many times that the PBMs are audited. So every time that we engage in a piece of business, there includes audit rights. And so we are audited continuously from our plan sponsors, from states, from Department of Insurances, all the way down to other regulatory agencies. So we get audited a whole bunch, which is probably more time than I would like to spend on a routine basis getting audited. Just similarly, the pharmacies probably have that same sentiment about us. They probably just don't see the full transparency about when those happen.
Thank you. And
you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And back to Mr. Garcia. So Prime Therapeutics, right? What is your relationship with Express Scripts?
You're recognized.
I'm actually not too familiar with our relationship with Express Scripts. I do know that we utilize some of their networks to get more competitive pricing.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Express Scripts, from what I understand, is owned by CVS.
No, ma'am, that is not correct.
Okay.
You're going fast.
Yes, I'm trying. I'm trying, Mr. Chair.
Take a breath. We're
okay. I'm trying, Mr. Chair.
We're all right.
I want to give everybody a chance. Okay.
If you want a second bite at the apple.
I'll get back to that momentarily. And then I have a couple of questions for Dr. Mortarana. Thank you. I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So United owns Optum, and Optum created a GPO, which is a group purchasing organization called MSR, based in Ireland, correct?
You're recognized?
That might be correct. I don't know that for a fact.
Okay. That is for folks here and for you, that is an organization that you guys created that is in Ireland. So the rebates, actually, from what I understand, are going to other countries. This is just from my notes. So if that's the case, how do Floridians get lower prices at the counter by your affiliate taking rebates to Ireland? There are no PBMs in Europe. So what's going on? And sir, I guess you say you can't answer to that?
You're recognized.
No, I'm no longer with Optum, and the division of Optum that I used
here?
To work for was on the hospital side, not on the pharmacy side.
I'm guessing there's somebody out there in the audience who will follow up with you.
Oh yeah, I will wrap it up since you say you don't know anything about that. I won't ask you any more questions. Sir, thank you for responding. So I'm going to go to Kevin. With Panama Pharmacy. Just if you don't mind, can you add a little bit of perspective by answering this question for me? You have someone, if you're in a rural area, by the way, I'm in House District 1. My area is, it takes an hour to get from one end of my district to a hospital, depending on, you know, if you live in the far north end. And we have a pharmacy, a small pharmacy, a Jackson Pharmacy, that is in my community, a super cool guy. My sister is a pharmacist of 20 years, graduated from FAMU Pharmacy School. And so I'm very familiar with this world here. But I would like for you to explain to some of the members and maybe audience that's not really familiar, what we're even talking about. So if I'm a patient and I live in a rural community and I know you, you're my neighbor, or I shop at your store, I go to your pharmacy to get my Advil or whatever, and now all of a sudden I work at a big corporation, I won't name one, and I have an insurance plan. I come to you, I say, oh my gosh, my doctor said I need cholesterol medicine or whatever, and they say, I want you to fill it. You say, I'm not in network. They don't understand that. They just want to use you because they trust you. They know you'll call them if they need anything or if something's going on. You try to fill it. It cost them 50 cents, but it cost you a dollar, but it wouldn't have cost another pharmacy company a dollar because they're in network. It would have cost them 12 cents or whatever. Can you explain that cost issue that we see with our patients? Because we're talking about access to care here. For me, it's about access to care.
All right, we're going to let him answer the question.
Thank you. Sorry. Thank you. Thank you, Randy. Thank you.
You're recognized.
Thank you. Yes, so I have, I'm not in a rural area, but I do have similar issues with patients and having access to care. So one of my stores is in a very minority, low socioeconomic status area of Jacksonville. And so we see a lot of people that are on Medicaid. And as a result, someone who may be able to pay a dollar or $3 or $5 for a cholesterol medicine, they are unable to pay that. That is an insurmountable amount of money for them to pay every month. But at the same time, I alluded to earlier, there are some Medicaid plans that I am not welcome to participate in this state. So what that means is, even though the person may live at the house on 27 East 63rd Street, right next door to where my pharmacy is, they have to instead take a bus and then change on that bus to take a different bus to get to their in-network pharmacy. So, I mean, it's very difficult for people to receive medications, and so I think that the presence of a pharmacy in a community does not necessarily mean that pharmacy services will be able to be provided to all persons in that community. And it's a very big problem that we see with these networks and our inability to participate in some of these networks.
All right. Thank you. And Rep. Salzman, we're going to move on. Okay. If there's more time at the end, I'm happy to give you another bite at it. Representative Masullo, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you started your committee, you said that this was a very obscure topic. Well, it is. And I think our goal here is to try to provide some transparency. But I'll caution all the members of the committee as well as the audience. Whenever you have something obscure and you start to try to clean it up, it gets a little bit more opaque, at least initially, and a little bit messy. And I'm sure we all can see that from what's happening. But I want to thank all the people here on the panel that have showed up to actually testify for us. I have a couple questions. First of all, I want to say, Dr. Maritano, am I pronouncing your name correctly? Morano. I agree with you. The PBMs are managing healthcare delivery. However, I'm not sure that was their intended function. I'd like to think that's the function of the provider. But you do that, and you do that by managing step therapy, by basically changing drugs on formularies, and oftentimes those are based more on initial pricing and not necessarily long-term benefits. And I think that's something that the committee certainly is concerned about. And we've heard a lot of things about how PBMs are influential in pharmacies. I'd like to get to how they actually influence our consumers, our patients, and our constituents. There's a...
question, sorry.
Getting to it. I'm trying to tee it up.
All
Mr.
Right.
Chair, I would never want to make your committee less efficient or effective than I know how you like to run it. There is a question here. There's an issue of copay accumulators, and what that is exactly is oftentimes there's rebates from various entities, even sometimes drug manufacturers that patients have when they come to fill a prescription. And those rebates, my understanding, either go back to the PBM or to the health plan. And they could be representative of several thousands of dollars, particularly on these more expensive personalized medicines. Now, oftentimes, once those rebates are finished, the patient then is basically faced with paying their deductible or their copay on top of the rebates that have already been refunded. So in a way, the health plan or the PBMs are double dipping on that type of money source. Can you explain why that occurs?
You're recognized.
I am not, you know, and I have been in several managed care organizations and have worked with employer groups, large, you know, self-funded or fully funded plans, not aware that any of the pharmacy benefits that we've had have that accumulation that you have. I see Mr. Garcia or Dr. Garcia is chomping at the bit, so I'll defer to him, but I'm not familiar with, at least in the plans that I've been affiliated with, that we've had that. You know, usually the copay or deductible is what it is. Now, with some of the more recent HSAs, health savings account, or the high deductible plans, the pharmacy benefit actually starts on dollar one. So if your out-of-pocket max is, say, you know, $3,000 a year, that, you know, when you go to a pharmacy, whatever you're getting at the pharmacy, whether that's, you know, it's not a copay or a deductible at that point, it's the dollar one from payment to fulfill your out-of-pocket max.
Mm-hmm. You have a follow-up?
Yeah, I do. Dr. Garcia, can you comment on the copay accumulator issue?
Yeah, I'll try to clear up a little bit here as well. So typically they're not rebates, they're coupons. So manufacturers will provide a coupon to initiate a patient on a medication. So it's a great marketing tool for them. There are certain stipulations in the IRS code that do not allow us to apply coupons to a patient who has a high deductible health plan tied to an HSA. So it is the patient's responsibility to pay the initial costs, so they cannot apply to the deductible based on IRS rules.
And just for benefit of time, there's seven more members
okay. Who
have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll hold it in case
okay.
you
and if we have
an opportunity
time,
to go around.
Yeah, okay. Representative Woodson, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I may be recognized for two questions, at least.
Two.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much for your presentation. And we have a lot of questions. Unfortunately, we don't have the time. But I have to make sure that some of those questions are answered because I represent a large constituency of seniors in South Florida. And one of the questions that we always have, why are medications so expensive? That's one, the high cost of medication. But one thing that is a low-hanging fruit that I would like to have some answer on today has to do with the different pharmacies, such as one of them they mentioned is Publix. Publix, they also mentioned independent pharmacies like Walgreens. Why aren't they allowed to deliver medications? Not delivering to really deliver medications in the home, just like you do it for the other pharmacies, like you can deliver medications. Why aren't Publix, Walgreens, and also the independent pharmacies allowed to do that? Because seniors do not drive, and they would like the medication to be delivered to their homes.
You're recognized.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. So at least my most recent research shows that Publix delivers to a 5-mile radius of their pharmacies. So I believe that they can deliver. Walgreens also delivers through their mail order pharmacies as well. There are some supply chain issues, some FDA requirements on how products are delivered. So if a pharmacy does not want to assume the responsibility of making sure the temperature is correct during that time, they may not opt to deliver a prescription.
Follow up
if Publix wants to answer that.
Yes.
I'd say there's several restrictions on contracts of what we can and cannot deliver. And we'll get, you know, notices from those PBMs if we try to offer delivery to their customers. So, of course, if the person's paying out of pocket themselves, we can deliver. But if it's under a contract from a PBM that has a mail order pharmacy, then we are not able to.
Okay. Second question.
Follow up.
Second question. Yet you can if the other six people.
Okay.
I don't mind.
All right.
I mean, we only have 35 more minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Second question.
All right. I'm going to ask the second question, and I would like you all to look at the delivery. The second question is price spreading, right? I would like to for you to really explain to us, break it down for us, because my understanding is, let's just say you determine the plan, how much the plan would pay for the medication. Let's just say you determine it's $100, right? So the pharmacy, for example, let's just say Publix. Publix would get $60 and you get $40 as the PBM. Just an example. I don't know how much, but I'm just using that as an example. That $40 that you get, is there any amount of that that is passed down to the consumers since we're having such an issue with high pricing of medication?
You're recognized.
Chairman, so for Prime Therapeutics, we're 100% pass-through. So what we would do is take that $40, and we'd pass it back to Florida Blue, who's our insurer, and they would use that to lower deductibles and premiums.
Florida Blue?
All right, I'm putting you on the list for the second pass if
okay.
we get there, okay?
Thank you, Chair. Thank
All right.
I come
Six
back.
More. And others may raise their hands, too. Representative Cross, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is for Ms. Pardee. I had a question about the rebates, and I believe you mentioned that the state of Virginia passed a law that was allowing these rebates to go directly back to consumers. Is that the right state first?
West Virginia.
West Virginia,
close,
okay.
Yes.
All right. Could you talk a little bit about if we were to implement a program like that in the state of Florida, where those rebates are going directly back to consumers, how much they could potentially save on their prescription drug cost?
Yes, absolutely.
Recognized.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, absolutely. In West Virginia, the way it's set up is that 100% of the rebate goes through to the consumer. The law just passed, and so we don't have a lot of data yet on what that looks like. But what you would see from our estimates is anywhere from a savings of, you know, $400 to $500 to up to $1,000 a year, depending on that individual's pharmaceutical, what drugs they're on. We also know from our studies that the impact on premiums is very insignificant. Looking at a top of maybe 0.6% increase, which you're talking maybe a couple dollars a month, for very significant savings. And remembering that you're going back to the people who most need this system, the sick, are then not compensating for the healthy, which is what's happening right now when they are not getting the benefit of these rebates.
Okay, thank you. Representative Koster, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. So I've learned in my short time in this process to follow the dollar, and there's clearly a lot of dollars involved just by looking out at the room. And I know that this is a super complex issue, so bear with me if I ask a stupid question, I apologize. But my understanding is, and I think we all would agree, that competitive pricing, competition, lowers prices, or at least it's supposed to. So my question involves drugs that have been around for decades and decades and decades that really haven't changed and that are, you know, somewhat commonplace, you know, for example, insulin, right? If we have so much competition and if we have all of these systems in place, and I apologize, my question's for Ms. Pardee, if you can answer it or if somebody else on the panel can answer it better, but why are we seeing drugs like insulin prices going up rather than going down when we have competition and we've got these systems in place? And I guess that would be my question.
You're recognized.
Thank you. So it's a great question, and obviously one of great concern is, you know, a lot of states and upcoming with the federal government have placed caps on insulin and other diabetic products, recognizing that there's a significant issue with insurance design. When I was speaking about rebates, insulin is one of the most highly rebated drugs out there. Obviously, there's a lot of products in this field, too. We're not talking about the insulin of many, many years ago. There's been tremendous innovation. But the estimate is about 85% rebates, and those rebates have increased about 155% over the last 10 years. So that's happening, but the patient on the other side is still paying a ton in cost sharing. They're still paying a percentage based on list price. They're still paying, you know, we don't have a system where a lot of people get first dollar coverage, which was recently mentioned. Moving towards that is great, but when that doesn't exist, they're paying in the deductible, and then they're paying high cost sharing. And so that's where we really need to look at what's happened in benefit design and how it's impacting patients.
Thank you. Representative Tribolsi, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two quick questions and a comment. My comment is we heard a lot, several times, and I'm going to flip both sides of the coin here. We heard a lot quality, price, and service, but we didn't necessarily hear access, so that was left out of the equation a little bit. On the other side, for Mr. Garcia, can you tell me, back to mail order, who makes the decision? Can you clarify that? Who makes the decision for mandatory mail order?
You're recognized.
Yes, ma'am. That's usually the employer as they're designing the benefits with the plan.
Okay, thank you. And then last...
Follow-up?
Yes, sir. Thank you. My last question is, can you clarify what Ms. Scanlon said, that PBMs own their own pharmacies? And if you do, is that somewhat of a conflict?
So
you're recognized.
Prime Therapeutics recently made a purchase with Magellan RX. So we're now back into the mail order pharmacy space. So prior to this year, we did not have the mail order pharmacy. So that might be a question for somebody else. But some PBMs do own a pharmacy branch, a mail order pharmacy branch.
Or an in-person pharmacy.
Or in-person retail pharmacies.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Rizzo, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. This question is for Dr. Scanlon, and in the sake of efficiency, I'll ask two questions at once.
Great.
Does Publix contract with a PBM for your own employee health insurance? And if so, why?
You're recognized.
Yes, we do. I think it's the space that we live in. I'm on the pharmacy provider side, so just by or self-funded. So I'm not a part of that conversation or decision. But yes, Publix does contract with the PBM.
Okay. All right. Ranking Member Skidmore, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this question is for the medical doctor. And I don't want to butcher your name. I heard from several of you that the employer chooses the PBM benefits and develops the plan. Is it a menu that they're choosing from, or is there a point at which the employer says, these are all the things that we want our employees to be able to access, and then you give the price of what that would cost? How do the employers choose?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So again, it varies by the type of plan that you're looking at. If it's self-funded, meaning that, you know, in public state case, the employer takes the risk of paying for the medical claims and the insurer is contracted for administrative services only, versus full risk, meaning they pay a premium and then the insurance company takes on that risk. Again, in my former life, I used to sit down with the HR representatives and the larger employer groups and with the pharmacy folks and say, okay, if we want to go ahead and have this network, which is pharmacies A, B, and C, the cost would be X. If you would want to go ahead and narrow that network to just pharmacies A and B, the cost could be Y. Again, to previous question as far as accessibility, that sometimes factors into it. Having a broader network usually means an increased price. A narrower network means you have sometimes a savings. As far as also sitting down with the employer groups, you can then go ahead and look at the formularies. So, you know, formularies, usually there's three or four tiers, meaning you pay. Tier one is the lowest copay. Tier four would be the highest copay or a percentage coinsurance. So depending on which formulary you choose, again, there would be different pricing that offsets as far as that. So is it a menu? Yes, in some instances it is. Sometimes, depending on the size of the employer group and how they're funded, they can go ahead and kind of narrow that or dictate how they want to do that, as far as sometimes even putting one or two specific drugs on a formulary, should they want to.
Follow up, Mr.
Yep,
Chair?
Yep, one follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we talk about competition then, and competition being the great equalizer in terms of a person being able to choose where they want to go. The competition isn't really then for the patient or the consumer. It's at the employer level. That's where the competition is, and the employer can choose by competing plans.
Well,
you're recognized.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, you're recognized.
Again, where this comes back to is then possibly the consumer, because usually employer groups offer more than one health plan. You know, so you can have an HMO, a PPO, a high deductible. You know, so you know you try to give the employer the choice of what plans they want, and then at the same time, and going back to the employee, you give them the type of plan that they want, with, again, a varying degree of cost share or cost responsibility.
Okay, yes, you'd like to shout at it?
Yeah, Chairman, also to add to that. So yes, it's a competitive RFP process. So an employer would use Humana or Aetna and get two different bids to see which would be best for their employees.
Okay, who's next? Representative Yarkovsky, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple notes I took here. One of you gentlemen mentioned a PSAO earlier, and I definitely agree with Chairman Masullo that it gets more opaque before it gets clearer. My understanding, those are third-party administrators for the independent pharmacists. What is the difference between a PSAO and a PBM, if you don't mind? And then second question is, independent pharmacies members of one or the other or both, or how exactly does that work?
You're recognized.
So a PSAO is a third party and typically owned by a wholesaler. So Cardinal, McKesson, AmerisourceBergen have their PSAOs. PSAOs were designed to handle independent pharmacies. I believe Mr. Duane over there is part of a PSAO, but they have larger purchasing power when they join one of these. So sometimes some of these PSAOs can be larger than a Walgreens or a CVS in terms of the number of members that they have. And then the PSAOs may or may not require that pharmacy to use their wholesaler to make the purchases of the drugs. With Prime Therapeutics, we do directly contract with some independent pharmacies directly, so they would come straight to the PBM and have their contract. Others choose to use a PSAO to make those contract negotiations on their behalf.
Mr. Duane, since he threw out your name, if you want to say something.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that.
He didn't look happy.
I was surprised that he knew that I was a member of a PSAO. I didn't know that that was generally publicly available information. But I can tell you that PSAOs, I am a member of a PSAO. I use one. The one that I use is one that's owned by pharmacists, like a co-op. And they help me with administrative burden. They help me understand which contracts that I'm in. They help me understand if the school board changes to a new plan in my county that I need to make sure that I'm on that contract with the school board. They make sure that if I lose a check in the mail because the postal service isn't very good where we are, that I make sure that I get that check reissued. That's the kind of things that they do. The one thing that I'll tell you about PSAOs is that the United States Government Accountability Office, they did a research project about PSAOs. And in their report, they said, quote, over half of PSAOs reported having little success in modifying certain contract terms as a result of negotiations. This may be due to PBM's use of standard contract terms and the dominant market share of the largest PBMs. Many PBM contracts contain standard terms and conditions that are largely non-negotiable. I brought that with me specifically because the PSAOs have become kind of a talking point to distract ourselves away from what the true issues are. And I just want to be very clear that when we talk about PSAOs, PSAOs are something that I pay $179 a month for to literally make sure that I don't lose a check in the mail or that a claim that I billed 3 weeks ago actually got paid. That's their role.
Representative Clemens, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks to all the folks who are here today. Mr. Chairman, this is like peeling back layers of an onion. Closer you get to the core, the more tears are shed. Could be tears of joy, could be tears of pain.
I'm not sure your mic is working, actually. I don't see the little green light on the... I'm going to have to lean over.
Okay.
I don't see the little green light at the end of this thing, so I don't think it's working.
Probably purposeful. My question is for Ms. Scanlon from Publix. You mentioned that 1,324 stores, 1,246 have pharmacies in seven states, and 700 and maybe 80 something in Florida with 175,000 employees. help me with it. You're not large enough, according to what I'm hearing, to have the volume buying or the volume discounting or the rebates or whatever. How large does Publix have to be to get into the club?
You're recognized.
Thank you. That's a wonderful question. I think we're wondering the same. And typically, it's a national, if you're a national player, is my understanding. I obviously don't have any insight into what the national pharmacies' contracts are. But yes, unless you're a national pharmacy.
Follow up, yep.
Well,
good question.
If three PBMs control 80% of the market, how is anyone ever supposed to pierce that veil to get into the land of Oz so that the patient can get drugs or pharmaceuticals or prescriptions that's lower?
You're recognized.
I think we have the same question.
Mr. Chairman, in closing, I just feel that, you know, this is like the movie when I was a little boy, The Wizard of Oz, which scared me to death. But, you know, when people start asking questions, you know, then the big fire and stuff comes out, and they said, don't pay attention to the little guy behind the curtain. We're just trying to find the little guy behind the curtain, you know, to try to figure some of this out. So I applaud everyone that's here today, and I'll yield to any other questions.
Great. Anybody else? Yes, Representative Grant.
Thank you, Chairman. This is directed to Scanlon. You're operating in multiple states. Can you tell us briefly the difference between what you do here in Georgia, I mean, what you do here in Florida versus how your customers engage with you in, like, Georgia or some other states, and in good, bad, or indifferent?
Sure, yeah. Because we have a larger presence in Florida, we certainly are invited into more networks, and, you know, we have, I'd say more on the Medicare space and preferred pharmacies and stuff because of our presence. But in the other states, it's a similar story.
Representative Edmonds, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if you all stated this, but what are those three PBMs that control 80% of the market? Anyone can answer.
You're recognized, whoever wants to take a shot at it.
I'll give a shot. So CVS Caremark is one of the largest. Express Scripts, and I will probably yield to the third question so I don't make a fool of myself to either the gentleman to my left or to Mr. Garcia.
You're recognized.
I believe it came from the yield back to pharma.
Whoever wants.
She mentioned it in her presentation.
OptumRx. OptumRx is the third one.
Okay. All right. So anyone who hasn't asked a question would like to. Okay, who's a member? All right, so we're going to do a three follow-ups, and then I've got a couple. Whip Salzman, you're recognized for a follow-up. One.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of got into the weeds because a lot of folks had made the point for me. It's an onion. We're peeling back layers, and everybody's connected. I talk about Express Scripts. It's actually owned by Cigna. I'm sorry. But the point is, the companies own the companies that own the companies. The control stays within those companies. How do we have a free market? How do we have freedom in Florida if we're bound to contracts and people that have names upon names of companies upon companies, and even people that are supposed to be well-versed in this topic are still confused? So I just want to ask, and whomever wants to answer can answer, if we're already sharing the rebates, and I'd like an answer. Don't just everybody nod. If we're already sharing the rebates, then a rebate pass-through doesn't actually affect you. So would you support passing the rebates on to the patients?
Whoever wants to take a shot, if anyone. We obviously can't force you to answer, but if someone would like to answer Whip Salzman's question, you're welcome.
Yes, we can.
I don't know.
I'll answer.
Okay, yep.
So obviously, no skin in the game there, because if it passes through to the consumer, then I, you know, just collect less money from them at the pharmacy counter. But I can tell you that many plan designs now operate on a co-insurance model where, like, you have to pay 20% of what the drug costs, and then the insurance company pays 80%. Actually, the health plan that I buy for my employees, that's the design that we have. So if the rebates pass through, then they would pay less at the counter because the drug would cost less money. So I think most people would tell you that would be a welcome change.
Anybody else? Yes, Ms. Pardee.
I think I addressed it earlier, but yes, we're very supportive of it, and it goes back to exactly what we're saying. When you're seeing these high cost sharing amounts, there's so many challenges, and then you have so many people leaving scripts and not being able to pick them up. And we really need to focus on what's happening at the pharmacy counter, what's directly impacting patients, along with so many other reforms. But yes.
Thank you. Representative Yarkovsky, you're recognized for one follow-up.
Thank you, Chairman. One question just for the independent pharmacist, Dr. Duane. Just so I'm clear, ideally, what is it that how you would like to see this set up? You know, like, what are the independent business owners, what would they like to see? Because I want to be clear on you know, what that business community is looking for.
You're recognized.
The main thing is, I think that on a free and fair playing field in this state, that people will see the value in our services and they will continue to patronize us. I think that our patient counts would grow. But we just don't have that right now because we're not able to participate in networks. We're offered contracts that we can't negotiate. We're offered costs, payment models that are underneath the cost that it would take us to employ employees to do the job. So I think that has to be part of it. And then I think the other thing is pharmacy owners in general would tell you that, you know, dispensing medications can be just a small subset of what we can ultimately do at the pharmacy counter, but it's still an integral part of what we do. So seeing a model that's tied to a definite or evidence-based cost for a medicine and then a definite evidence-based cost to provide that medicine to a patient makes the most sense to me. It's the way that the Medicaid fee-for-service program is set up in this state. And it really says, okay, we're going to make sure that you're not losing money by taking care of our patients and give you the opportunity to do other things that add value to your community.
Ranking Member Skidmore, you're recognized for one follow-up question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is to Ms. Pardee, I think. And this is really sort of a fundamental elementary question. I'm trying to wrap my head around the rebates. And because I really like semantics, I think I'm getting tripped up by the word. Can you just explain who pays the rebate to whom and why?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Yes, I can, and it is very confusing. The chart behind is helpful. What I focused on today was the manufacturer rebates to the PBMs. And so that sort of big number you hear, quite frankly, the one that we discussed passing down. And those are going to look like rebates, negotiations, price concessions. There's a lot of different names for them, but that bulk of it is what happens to get your drug covered, to make sure your drug is on a decent tier, to make sure that your drug is, you know, ideally not overpriced, but unfortunately it's not helping in the pharmaceutical benefit in the way that it should. Now, throughout the supply chain, when you have these many stakeholders, there are a number of price concessions and rebates that go back and forth between them. It's a much smaller amount, but there's, you know, everybody in the supply chain, you know, is getting paid for their services in one way. But ultimately, right now, it's unfortunately directly related to the cost of a drug, because everyone in the supply chain is benefiting when the drug prices, you know, the list price is higher because there's that portion they're taking. And that's really where I think a lot of the focus should be, is where are these rebates going? How are they being used? And are they lowering the pharmaceutical benefit for patients?
All right, so I have a couple questions. My first question relates to rebates. So obviously, when you have a price for a product unrebated, it's easier for that price to be transparent. You know, the price of the drug on the wholesale market is $3.25. It is what it is, and yours is $3.27, and so I can buy the cheaper one. My question is a broader question, which is, why do we have to have a price and rebate model for these drugs at all? Why can't we just have prices for drugs? And you can, I'm interested in anyone's perspective, but I'll give you the chance to start.
I think that as we look at this nationally and we continue to see this problem, that's a very good question that needs to be answered. Is this rebate model failing? Do we need to look back at where we originally saw things as more of a fee-based model? Okay. and how that can impact the system.
All right, so I'm going to cut you off because we only have a little bit of time. So I'm going to ask a different question. I know everyone in the industry here, but we have, you know, who of the six of you likes the idea, would like us to continue having this rebate model as opposed to, say, what Walmart did years ago with their everyday low pricing system? I mean, which of you like the idea of rebates and say, this is great, we should keep on doing it, as opposed to a drug costs what it costs? Who here advocates for rebates? Anybody? It's okay. You're not in trouble if you do. I'm learning. I'm trying to find out who likes this, because all I hear is it's problems. So who thinks it's good? Yeah. Mr. Garcia.
So hard to take a stance on that without seeing specific language, I think. But
I just came up with this question while I was sitting here.
And rebates were, you know, created by the drug manufacturers in the 90s, and they lost a court case. So there's history behind this that probably needs to be unraveled.
Okay. All right. Well, no one's up here cheering for rebates is what I take away. Second question, and this is a question to the PBMs. And so I think part of the reason this is such an issue, because there's something that's hard for people to swallow. And so when you're the middleman and you own the retailer, it creates the perception of favoritism. So I don't know anything about healthcare, but I do know something about business. I did it for a long time. Now, when I bought a company, I had to go to my shareholders, which oftentimes was just my wife, and say, I'm buying this company because the whole is worth more than the sum of the parts. There are synergies involved. So this company is worth X. My company's doing $20 million in profits. This one's doing $15 million. I put them together, and we're going to make $70 million. In order to get those synergies, you have to integrate the two businesses. If I were to buy another company and there not be synergies, if I would say, no, they're completely separate, then I would be breaching my fiduciary duty to my shareholders to get the greatest return on the monies that's involved. So my question is for the PBMs that own a retailer, which of the two are they doing? Are they breaching their obligation to their shareholders to get the highest return by integrating the businesses because they're completely separate? Or are they somehow integrating those businesses to unlock synergies in order to be consistent with their fiduciary obligations to their shareholders? It's got to be one of the two. Yeah.
Prime doesn't own any retail pharmacy, okay. So I can't answer that question.
There you go. All right. Yep.
I would like to say your board of directors is pretty rough then.
You have no idea.
So I think it's one of those things. It's a complicated answer, and I think the perception is exactly what you say, that we're going to be using market share to go ahead and benefit internal parties. But if you look at it from a client perspective, I have to win business against people like Prime Therapeutics, against other people. And if I don't have a connected retailer that's at least not the highest cost person, so we need to have everyone be a low-cost provider in order for the business to come to CVS Health. So we go to great lengths to make sure that we avoid any look of impropriety. Like when we do audits, we actually have a third party that uses our same methodology. So we unlock it. Hopefully there's innovation there that the closeness goes in, but we also have a lot of innovation that we do with Publix and with Walgreens as well.
Okay, and I'm not saying it's real. I'm just saying I think that's part of what overlies the issue is the perception. So that's it. Well, look, I think we had a great conversation. We probably could go for another 90 minutes here. I apologize. I was in the back of my mind. I stupidly thought, hey, maybe we'll have time for public comment. But that obviously was not the case here. I do think you're going to see something come out of our committee at some point on this, but I think what that is and when I think is up in the air. So I know many of the members of this committee have shown a great deal of interest, and I encourage all of you to continue to work with us and educate us along the way. And I do apologize that we didn't have time for public comment along the way. So with that, that concludes our agenda for today. I do think we'll probably meet next week or week after next, but more to come on that. This concludes our committee agenda. Representative Masullo moves we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.